Well, welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb Keith, and I am joined by Adam Francisco, Rod Rosenblatt, Scott Keith, and special guest Greg Kokel.
Oh, there you go.
Thank you.
Today's episode of the Thinking Fellows is being recorded live at Here We Still Stand 2023. The theme of the conference this year is C.S. Lewis and the Untamed God. If you're listening to this not live, you probably need to quickly register for next year's conference. Because you wanted to be here this year, and you couldn't make it because we sold out. And so you should definitely go check out the links in the show notes below. As usual, the Thinking Fellows is brought to you by the 1517 Podcast Network of shows. You can go to 1517.org/podcasts to see all of our shows. And don't forget to subscribe in your favorite podcasting app. To follow the theme of the conference today, we are going to discuss C.S. Lewis. And we've done this numerous times on the Thinking Fellows. In fact, our most popular episode of the show ever was our original C.S. Lewis episode, just titled C.S. Lewis. And it, you know, I think that episode helped put us on the map outside of our circle of Lutheran churches and Lutherans who were listening to the show. And so it's always been a great treat to come back and discuss Lewis. In fact, a couple of years ago, we reread through the Narnia series. We did all of the books in Narnia, and we did a couple of episodes on the relationship between Lewis and Tolkien. And so today we're going to revisit Lewis generally in the theme of the conference, but I want to ask the question to the fellows and in various ways here, why is C.S. Lewis so well-liked and used? It seems that most Christian denominations can't agree about much. We seem to bicker and fight a lot. Us Protestants don't get along. But the one thing we're united on is that C.S. Lewis is pretty cool. C.S. Lewis is pretty great. We all want to claim him. There's probably a bit of a habit for Lutherans to make Lewis a little bit Lutheran, for Calvinists to make Lewis a little bit Calvinist. And since he belonged to the Church of England, I think that's fair, right? We can all steal a little bit of a piece of Lewis. But today I want to present, especially in sort of the three areas of impact that he had, theological impact, apologetic impact, and literary impact. Why is he so well-liked and used? I know, Rod, you probably introduced rereading Lewis or reading Lewis in a new light to so many of us at Concordia and at this table. Why do you think Lewis is so well-regarded?
Well, one of the books I'm going to refer to in my later talk is by Richard Pertill, a Roman Catholic professor of philosophy in Western Washington. And he has a book titled C.S. Lewis's Case for the Christian Faith. Richard Pertill. There'll be downloadable outlines of that for any of you who want them. See Ted as to how to download them. I put a lot of what Ed heads call enrichment material up there for you for free. But Pertill singles out about three or four reasons: his cognitive intellectual abilities, his imaginative breadth. He leaves out, but I think we should add, he spoke the language to whom he was sent as a missionary. It's called English.
Yeah.
But Pertill has those, and you'll be able to download what he says or outline of his book here for free. I'm going to make available at 1517 a whole bunch of book outlines. They're not uploaded yet, but the board decided not to sell them but to give them away for free. So some of my students, three institutions over 30 years, who instead of doing the dreaded term paper could do a book outline of a Christian classic, chose to do that. And I cherry-picked the best ones, and all of those, when they figure out how to upload them and now they're going to do the distinctions, all will be free for you to download, just so you know.
I wonder, you know, picking up off of your comment about that he spoke the language of those he was sent to, English. If there, you know, when we reference Lewis, especially let's say as an apologist, it's not typically about a particular apologetic methodology, but him as an apologist,
right?
The apologetics of C.S. Lewis, and you know, playing off of a book that you wrote, Greg, Tactics, mm-hmm. Greg, that great book we've promoted on the show many times. We hope that we've increased your sales just a little bit.
Yeah. So do I. I have a new one out, by the way. I just saying.
I wonder if maybe you can identify or help people identify the particular tactic or language that Lewis uses that makes his apologetic. Now we're getting closer to 100 years old, even with
right.
Mere Christianity, so useful to even hand people today still.
Right. I think he's had a big impact on, say, Chuck Colson's life, for example. I mean, just from all levels, you know, from the top to the bottom. Although nowadays some students find him hard to read, I think he's among the most accessible of readers. And partly because he's just got this avuncular kind of approach. Like he said, uncle, you know, just chatting with you about spiritual things. It's very conversational, very accessible. But his apologetics, the way I characterize his apologetics are soft apologetics. Mm-hmm. So he kind of slips them in here and there. If you read in A Mere Christianity, well, the first couple chapters is the moral argument for the existence of God. But you're not going to get a syllogism. You're going to get this kind of casual reflection on life, drawing on common sense realities, the way people talk about things and how they reveal their inner convictions about the nature of reality. And then he says, these are inner convictions that tell you something true about reality. And then he begins to connect the dots and make the case for God there. And this, I think, is a tremendous approach. And I think one of the reasons he's had such an enduring appeal is because of this kind of soft approach. He kind of slips in when you're not expecting it. And he's just raising issues, and then he'll say, you're probably asking this question now right about this moment. So let me just speak to that a little bit, you know, just to resolve it and have a little side chapter in Mere Christianity. And I think that's been one of the most powerful things that he's done as an apologist. Now, he's got other works that are a little bit more straightforward and whatever, but Mere Christianity, I think, has endured for that reason. It's a tremendously subtle but sound approach to making the case for core principles of Christianity. That's, I think, one of the things that keeps us all saying, yeah, he's ours. You know, he's all of ours, because he's flying at about 30,000 feet and looking at Mere Christianity. And I think that's a benefit as well.
Yeah, I wonder, too, when I've spent some time trying to examine his literary theology as well. And there is something even straightforward about that that we've talked about on the show that can be a criticism against him sometimes by, say, people who find the literature of Tolkien more enriching or exciting intellectually, which is that when Lewis decides to incorporate theological themes into his writing, fiction that is intentionally theological, like Screwtape or Great Divorce, or something that appears more like a novel, like The Chronicles of Narnia, he just does it. It's not coded or hidden. It's just plainly there to see. You don't have to be an exceptional, you know, analyzer of fiction to figure out what he's trying to get at. And mm-hmm. if the apologetic method, if the non-literary stuff is then even more direct, of course we feel like we can access it and probably, for a lot of us, understand it. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes apologetics has two realms. It has the realm of the technical knowledge, which some find extremely stimulating and easy to, or exciting to learn and to study and to use. And then there's sort of the realm of getting daily questions or challenges or doubts approached or confessed against your faith mm-hmm. on the regular. And you kind of need, in a way, to engage those conversations apart from just being a technical master of particular realm of knowledge.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. He also avoids abstraction.
He is.
One of the things, I think it was Walter Hooper, said that Lewis was the most thoroughly converted man he'd ever met.
Mm-hmm.
And it's and throughout everything that Lewis writes, maybe not the technical academic stuff like the on the English literature in the 16th century, but is this thread that's not always stated, but this assumption when Lewis is writing, he knows he's writing to an audience, as he puts it in the Weight of Glory, that is not mere mortal. You've never met a mere mortal. Even Ted Rosenblatt is not immortal.
Wait a minute.
All people have immortal souls, and he's writing towards that, so he doesn't have time to mess around. I've got other words for that in abstract thought and ideologies. In fact, he, in a way, in principle, opposes ideologies and abstractions and sticks to the real. The term we would use today, I think, is authentic. What's really
concrete,
essential. Yeah.
He's able to get points across in a way that the average person of his time, especially, and even now, can understand. But I was always amazed that once you start reading more Lewis, how technical he's able to get to. I mean, one of the things you find the more you read about Lewis or read primary sources from Lewis is that he had such a broad ability with languages, with the English language, with theology, with literature, even with history to some degree. He's an amazing scholar. I remember when we first started 1517, the only people we asked to write were academics. This isn't the case as much anymore, but we gathered together about 15 people with PhDs and said, okay, now we want you to write so that people can understand you. And almost to a man, they were like, no, we're serious. We need you to write so that people can understand you, and it needs to be short. And they all to a man were again, oh, I can do 4,000 words. I'm like, we're talking
about
between
800?
Yeah, 500 and 1,000, and it needs to be in words that a person, you know, with a decent high school education can easily understand, and you can still get your point across, whatever theological point you're trying to make, in a way that's meaningful and impactful. And many of them are very good at it now, but the amount of time that it sort of took to reframe your brain, because when you're taught and trained to the level, certainly that C.S. Lewis was in his particular field of literature, they called it the greats, right, Adam? He sort of taught what we might call like a classical education now. When you're brought up to that level, for many people, it's very hard to then just learn how to talk to people, just everyday people. And that, to me, that's why that's the big reason why everybody claims him, is that when he writes, people hear C.S. Lewis talking to them.
Mm-hmm. But there's another side to this, it seems to me. I mean, I read like Weight of Glory and Transposition. I got to read that like 5 times
part
to make
full
sense of it, you know?
Yeah.
So there's this whole part of him, and this is part of his broad appeal, I think, this whole part of him that speaks to these very esoteric concepts that are deeply profound, but you got to read slowly to digest them and understand them. Then at the other hand, and you mentioned Chronicles, I mean, I just read The Horse and the Boy the other day. And the reason I like Chronicles is because these are pieces that help me as a follower of Jesus to navigate the world. You know, I don't know if you guys ever noticed this, but whenever anybody in the Chronicles goes anywhere, it takes them a long, long, long
time. I mean, not as long as this for Tolkien characters.
Yeah.
I agree.
So, yeah. I mean, I don't know. Maybe he got that from MacDonald or somebody before him. But in any event, it's a message. It's a message that the Christian life is a long, long, long journey. And there are all kinds of crazy things that happen along the way. And you keep moving forward. Now, this to me is really evident when I read his stuff, where the horse and the boy, here's this guy, this kid complaining about his miserable life, but his miserable life has all been sovereignly set in place the way it's taken place, because Aslan arranged to rescue a whole people as a result of what happened to this young boy. I mean, I'm not going to do the spoiler if you haven't read it, but it's great because this is the way it seems a lot of times in our own life. We're just plodding along, and all these awful things seem to befall us, and it doesn't seem to make any sense until maybe at the very end of our stories, we look back and we see it all come together. And that's what's happening in The Horse and the Boy. So there are lots of very populist kinds of notions that become very evident to me and powerful because of the way Lewis characterizes it with his craft, that are very simple as you read these children's stories that are made for kids and then for later for adults, you know, kind of thing. But then there's this other stuff that's radically complex to my reading that that I have to go through a bunch of times to get deeper things that Lewis is trying to explain. So he reaches people on a whole host of different levels.
There's a reread value for sure. You know, as I was preparing for the conference and any reread slowly, the highlights and underlines you have previously in the book, you know, aren't adequate. You find things I had not thought about before, reapproaching Great Divorce. The first time you read it, you take it straight. It's about heaven and hell. You read it a little more slowly. Oh, I'm seeing the problem of evil here again, and evil in a much different way than, say, the problem of pain, where he deals with the personal weight of evil in this world on us here. In things like Great Divorce, if you can slowly go through it, you can see that he'll make the confession with us about sin, sort of that evil racks us daily, not just in these hard, extreme ways, but the very normal, in fact, ingrained sinful parts of our bound wills are evil when they appear totally just, totally, they make absolute sense in this world. And so he also has an ability to use the mirror of the law in a very unique way through literature and through this, you know, this free writing, where in some ways, you finally feel yourself as the object of that law in a way that isn't always true. We talk about all the time that when you preach the law, I really want you to preach the real law to me. I want you to put me to death with the law. I need that law always accuses law. And there's a point to where when Lewis can insert you into a story, you might finally see yourself as the object of that law.
I do like the encouragement to read slow, even Lewis. The now, our dear friend, now sainted Jim Nestegan, used to tell me, be careful not to read like Americans. Americans read like conquering armies. You know, like you open the book and you're going to get through it. And even if somebody is very adept at writing, you know, in everyday language to the common person, if they're writing on a weighty topic at all, it pays to slow down and to pay attention. And that's definitely the case with Lewis. I mean, Adam this weekend will be teaching on the abolition of man and probably read it five times before putting together a talk. That's a weighty, no matter which way you spin that book or read it, that's a weighty book. There's a lot going on in there that's deserving of your time and attention.
If he requires a commentary,
yeah,
to understand all the classical references and the nuances and the it's interesting because you can read it as well as many of his other books on a kind of surface level, like a conquering army, and kind of get the gist of it. Then you go back maybe a couple of days later, read it again, and you're like, whoa, this is getting deeper. Then you read it again, and you're like, whoa, this. It's almost like he's in a way kind of a representative of the great Western tradition.
Right.
That old classic Western man.
And it's his broadside against what you and I would call modern education.
I'd call it something worse than modern education, but
I want to ask you what you'd call it, but we're on air.
I haven't marked it as clean yet, so okay. he can go for it. But yeah. Well, I do have a separate question for each of you as well, because we've certainly spent some time reading through the works of Lewis on the show. In fact, now that you say Abolition of Man, I think we did do two or three episodes on that in the first couple of years of the show. The show's been going on so long now, and so much has happened at 1517.
But we don't even
remember. And in all our lives, it's hard to remember all of the episodes that we've done. But I am curious for each of you at this table, as you've taught, as you've worked with people, had personal interactions, or even developed your own written apologetic and theological works, which work of Lewis's or what aspect of Lewis's public teaching has had the greatest impact on what you've done and why?
So
we'll start with Rod, and we'll go to Greg, and we'll do the same way we just did it. We'll just let nature flow.
Well, I suppose remembering that his books were individual hardbound books when they came out. There was no Mere Christianity. That was some idiot at Macmillan Publishing House that said, let's paste three of these together, we'll make a million. It was originally published, each one is a small hardback, The Case for Christianity, Christian Behavior, and Beyond Personality. Those were individual works, and I think for me it was, no Lutheran ever recommended him, which I think is telling. No teacher I had at any Lutheran institution ever recommended Lewis for any reason. Strange. But the Case for Christianity, and I'm glad it was the start. But I got no recommends from any scholar under whom I studied until Dr. Montgomery that recommended Lewis on anything.
Well, thankfully the tide changed on that, because
you recommended it to 30 years of students.
Couldn't escape it. Greg?
Yeah, I'm going to refer back to something I said earlier, and it's something that I traded on very heavily in this new book I wrote, which I won't talk about.
You can talk about it. Yeah, go for it.
Sell the book. Street Smarts. I mean,
there you go. I think it's in the bookstore.
Yeah. Also available at the bookstore here. But
yeah.
But this subtleness in that I see, especially in Mere Christianity, this asking questions rhetorically that he does in the book, and he starts this out very aggressively. I mean, not aggressively, but in a very plain sense, it's very clear what he's doing. Why do people talk the way they talk? I think this is his first page. You know, why do they say, please give me some of your thing because I gave you some of mine, et cetera, et cetera. What he's referring to is a moral intuitions that express themselves in behaviors. So what he's doing is just drawing from common sense principles that people acknowledge that turn out to make sense in a Christian view of reality, but make no sense in alternate religious views, certainly atheism, okay, and secularism. None of these views make any, these comments that we say all the time make any sense. And that's really influenced my interactions with other people because, as you pointed out with Tactics, that's another book, that
probably the bookstore.
I really focus on questions, asking questions. Questions keep you safe. So Lewis did it rhetorically, but we can do it in our conversations with people. If we make progress by asking the right kinds of questions, the kinds of questions that surface common sense intuitions, all right? Something's wrong with the world. What's wrong with the world? Everybody knows that something's wrong with the world. That's why they talk about the problem of evil. But of course, there can only be a problem of evil if there is objective morality, which atheists deny. All right? I won't go through the whole string of thinking there. Most of you could already follow this. But so it turns out that the problem of evil is not the problem for Christians that people think it is. It's the problem for atheists. Okay? Now, how do we get there? Well, we just ask some basic questions, just like Lewis did, about our normal intuitions about reality. And when we ask those right questions, people start putting pieces on the table that all are meant to make our case. And this is what Lewis does, especially in the first half of the book. When he gets into more theological stuff towards the end, unique things about Christianity, he's doing something different.
But catechizing. He's catechizing at that point.
Yeah, he's catechizing, but he's also kind of appealing to common sense notions. This makes sense when you think about it. And that, I think, is probably with Lewis has taught me more than anything else in terms of making a case for Christianity. It fits reality and our common sense intuitions about the most important things about the world.
Great. Well, Adam, you're going to need to pick something besides,
is The Case for Christianity. I mean, on one hand, that was the first apologetic book I read because you required it. And for me, life hasn't been the same since, for the good. All of a sudden, it was like, wait, Christianity is true, like in a real?
Yeah. concrete sense,
yep.
factual sense,
yep.
but also it's significant in the history of apologetics. That, I mean, apologetics was, for the most part, the province of abstract philosophical thinkers until you get to C.S. Lewis in the mid-20th century when he's... I learned just the other day when he went to the BBC in London to record the broadcast talk. He was literally climbing over sandbags and things
to get there,
to get into the recording studio. That's remarkable. But if I have to choose a different topic or a different book, I'm going to say the last two paragraphs of The Way to Glory are just
amazing.
You take it to heart, it will rattle your world because it will change the way you view of the other. It's not just Ted. To use that reference again, this is somebody who really matters, not just to me. I mean, you mean a lot to me, Ted, but it means a whole lot to God.
Yeah.
And so there's this sort of call, there's probably different ways we could describe it, but this evangelical zeal to an Oxford professor's writings that is just like no other.
I think you can feel for that too, the reality of that for people when they have family members or children or close friends who are leaving the faith or saying that they're leaving the faith, that pain of that this person is eternal is felt in a really hard way. And, you know, something like The Weight of Glory and many of other of Lewis's other works, I think can help you navigate then how to keep the conversation open with somebody to whom the doors of heaven are open.
And even to people that you don't want to like.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And
lawyers.
You know, I'm so glad you said lawyers. There were other options. It would have been more uncomfortable.
Oh, my turn. I'm going to take two because you can't tell me what to do. I'm going to start kind of moving from most recent back. Mere Christianity, but just to make Rod happy, specifically The Case for Christianity, the first part of that. I taught at the university too, where Rod taught not anywhere near as long as he did, but taught the basic class to transfer students. So everybody that goes there has to take a certain amount of theology classes. One of them is just called theology, core theology. And I taught that to transfer students. Transfer students at this university are, on the whole, you know, some of them are Christian, but many of them aren't. And so they're, for the first time in their life, hearing about Jesus in a real way, and they're supposed to take a class that's, you know, it's a university-level class on Christian theology, and they've never really interacted with any of this kind of thing before, period, the end. And so you assign Mere Christianity, and they can make their way through it, but it more than any other book we assigned for that class, it caused conversations that on more than one occasion, and not just with me in my class, I know from other people who taught the core theology class too, often brought people to the faith. I mean, the number of baptisms that we had on chapels for unbelievers who had gone through core theology class and just ended up in deep conversations with their professors, often springboarded out of their reading of C.S. Lewis in that class, and the conversation was honestly phenomenal. We're talking people from other faiths, several Muslims, people of no faith whatsoever, the nuns. But I have a funny story about when Lewis says he's sharing this bit, that starts out with, "I gave you a bit of my orange, why won't you give me a bit of yours?" Yeah, modern university students are not that, you know, respectful. And I don't know if you know this. There's not a lot of hair professor stuff going on anymore. But I remember having one student that just popped up in his hand and said, "Why did anybody give a crap about an orange?" And, you know, having to explain that C.S. Lewis wrote this during World War II, in England, when they were under rations and were mostly eating powdered and canned food off of rations, and that if you got a fresh piece of fruit or an orange, this was a really, really big deal.
Yep.
So if somebody, you know, if 1 week you got the orange and you gave half to your buddy, and the next week he got the orange and he wouldn't give you half at that point too, this was a real insult. And having to explain that, it actually clicked with this guy. He's like, oh, okay.
It's really hard in our day and age, though, to communicate that kind of need. You know, we most of what we have are sort of our needs are taken care of. A lot of it else is like up and beyond that. But if I had to pick one that influenced me personally the most, it'd be the one that I'm speaking on Saturday. You shouldn't miss it. It's going to be a great talk. And that's the Four Loves. It's served as one of the key texts when I was writing Being Dad, Father is a Picture of God's Grace, on sale at the bookstore next door. If it doesn't sell out while you're here, I'm not sure. You maybe need to read Mere Christianity again because, you know, that type of thing. So, but that book just hit me. Every part of it, specifically the section on philia and friendship. So
it's great. Well, I'll take a swing at it as well. I feel the benefactor of generations of apologetics being taught and Lewis being handed down, not having to be in a position like Rod where no Lutheran wants to hand this over or teach these things. And so, case for Christianity and Mere Christianity were not a mind-blowing exposure to me for the first time. And not to say that I didn't need it, but it's just because I benefited from...
I wonder if somebody put that book in your hand early on.
Early on.
Yeah.
You know, and so you just benefit from these generations handing down good to you. And so, but then as you go on and you've been handed these books early and you think, oh, I've read everything already, and then you go to college and you go, I'm going to be a conquering army. I'm going to read every single thing Lewis has read, and you do it, and you do it very quickly. You find, oh, yes, I agree, I disagree, whatever. But Lewis kind of personally saved me from a pickle at the end of my master's program, which was you get to the point where I have to pitch my thesis idea, and, of course, I pitch a Reformation topic, and this is shot down. Not because it wouldn't be an interesting research topic, but I'm told I have done too many papers on the Reformation, and that all I've done is turn every assignment into a primary source. Look,
this
at
is
Lathan.
This
and
is Simeon Zoll, Dave Zoll's brother, who did this, right?
No, Simeon was gone before he. So Simeon had gone to Cambridge already. So he might have been able to save me out of this pickle, but didn't. And so. At first, I didn't really know where else to turn to do this. What my interest lied in at the time, Melanchthon. I wanted to do something on Melanchthon, and so... I wonder why that was. Yeah. No clue. So I cheated a little bit. I figured, okay, I'll go catechesis. Nobody can say catechesis is only Lutheran, but I can certainly spin this. We are the holders of the small catechism, after all. And then it came to me that, you know, the other person, especially in England, that people would really love is Lewis. And so I was able to pitch that I would do my thesis on catechesis and the use of literature in catechesis and the formation of Christian minds and teaching. And so Lewis, personally came to the rescue for me on this and being able to form a thesis, and the book that I used is the one that my talk will be on. You should definitely go to it. It's a breakout tomorrow afternoon. Caleb Keith, it's in the big room, in case you were wondering. And that was The Great Divorce. And I found that The Great Divorce is, it's a simple and short book. I really do think it's one of those ones that you can read very easily. You can read very quickly if you desire. But the more you go through it, each chapter has in it so many individual theological topics in it. You can find the doctrine of justification outlined in a catechetical way in there through conversations. You can find very specific instances of the doctrine of sin and the Ten Commandments and specific violations of those and how they hold on to our soul. You can hear Lewis handing over the gospel in his sort of cry that it is free. It is really, really free throughout there. And finally, sort of as we've talked about and Jim used to talk about, a life of catechesis, reading this. Jim would tell these stories about reading the small catechism morning after morning, walking with the small catechism.
Walking his dog as he would recite small catechism to his dog.
Yes. You can see that the Christian life is not just conversion. And I think something like a pilgrim's tale, like The Great Divorce, helps us with that, as well as the journey is hard and uncomfortable and painful. And the only sort of balm to that, the fact that life in this world, sinner saint, is painful, is that promise that you are a saint on account of Christ alone, that this blood of the Lamb that Lewis will revisit time and time again. And so I think, the great divorce had the greatest impact on me because, it personally saved me from a pickle. And in it, mm-hmm. I found, I think, a rich catechetical resource that you could use to pair with systematic learning in order to make people see how these things work out in their own lives and in their own ears, if that makes sense.
It's also, in one way or another, introduces us to the strange world of academe.
Right.
Lewis knew when he wrote his first popular book that his academic progress would end. And he was right. Mm. I mean, how strange is that? He wrote for commoners. I think this is not worthy of Oxford.
Right.
Really?
You told, when we were at Concordia, you used to recommend, you didn't actually assign it, because I don't know what class it would have been appropriate to assign that, but the Space Trilogy. Mm-hmm. And I remember when you were describing that hideous strength, and I had no clue what you were talking about. It took me years and years and years to decipher this little rodism. But you said, that hideous strength is an interesting commentary on academia and the academic life. Or a horrible comment, something like that. And I remember thinking when I was a student, what does that mean? The university is great. This is amazing. What could be better than this? And then rereading, it's when we went to Strasbourg several years ago. I reread it while we were there and was working at the university and reading it going, oh my gosh, you were so right.
Yeah, if you're ever tempted to trust bureaucracy, that hideous strength will cure you.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I think just maybe a couple of closing remarks. You guys can jump in if you want. The theme of the conference is the untamed God, which is playing off of a phrase with Aslan.
He's not right? A tame lion.
He's not a tame lion. And I think this is a sort of reoccurring theme that maybe even has to do with fairness in...
Yeah, in the original, there's a comma, but he is good.
But he is good.
And I think the reason this works so well for our Here We Still Stand conference is because it highlights that in Lewis still, even though his work is largely apologetic, even though he provides these great pictures, the final end to it is really God and what God has done and is the sole doer of. The lion is not tame because the lion is powerful and dangerous. And when we're first confronted with that, this is terrifying. It's only once Aslan becomes, or God becomes good to us and for us, that he becomes safe to approach.
Yeah.
And I think, that can be, too, the root of lots of apologetic questions as we get to suffering and pain. And like you said, the problem being different for the atheist than the Christian, too, is for us, the difference, and Lewis, I do think, brilliantly highlights this, is that we have this untamed God for us, not against us. Mm-hmm. And so the reminder is for us to go proclaim that God, go proclaim Christ to and for people for the forgiveness of sins, so they too then have an untamed God on their side.
And knowing it's going to sound strange because every single Sunday that is buried.
Right.
Yeah.
The pew figures are awful. If I'm just looking for absolution or I'm just looking for a good word, a benediction, anywhere in any church service, probably I'm going to be disappointed. Think about that. So what we're doing here is delivering something that the average Protestant parish in America ain't delivering. And it's a tremendous sort of critique on us.
Well, something like this happens in apologetic circles, too. And I think our temptation as apologists is to try to give an answer that's going to be satisfying to everybody. And the temptation is to try to sanitize the untamed God. Yep. You know, this is where Lewis's comment, you know, in his works, you know, is he safe? No, he's not safe, but he's good. And I think there's a scene with Jill Paul, and she wants to drink from the stream,
yep.
And there's the lion. And she has something like the same question, you know, oh, will you hurt me? Or something like that. He's, I can't remember the exact answer, but the answer was, yeah, maybe, because I've devoured little girls and boys and kings and kingdoms and everything. And so he emphasizes this idea that this is not a God that we can sanitize. And sometimes we go through the text, and we see the way God acts and what he does, and these are things right now under contest regarding the Old Testament and progressive churches, etc. We just got to say this is God's world, and God gets to decide how he deals with it.
Amen.
Because he is a good God, even if we don't see it that way from our value system.
That's great. Amen.
Yeah. What a fantastic place to end this episode of the Thinking Fellows podcast. I want to thank you for listening to this show. If you enjoyed this episode of the Thinking Fellows podcast, you can support the 1517 Podcast Network and the Thinking Fellows by going to 1517.org/donate. You can also subscribe this show. And the fastest way that podcasts grow is by sharing it with family and friends. So if you are enjoying the Thinking Fellows and there's somebody in your life who might like to listen to it, you can go ahead and share this episode with them. That would be greatly appreciated. We will catch you next time.
Bye.
Bye.